four of the same. I subject myself to the Son. He's coming to grips with that. There, point number two on the second column of 328, second line. He is full of mysteries and superior in strength to all men. Where's the power of creativity? And more, he continues on that vein. Just a couple of the points that are puzzling. The first line on the first column of 329. The absurd has entered the age-old mother, and the son has grown in the deepest ground. I was a little puzzled why he said absurd, unless he feels what he's going through is absurd.
I suppose that's how he described it in his rant, isn't it? He has an idea of his maidenly soul impregnated with this terrible worm,
mm-hmm.
and he found that absurd.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's what it is. And I think, you know, I don't know if we need to go into everything, because he's kind of repeating. He sprang up, was put to death. Well, we've seen that. He rose up again. We've seen that. I gave him a crown. We've seen that. Superior in strength. We've seen that. Did not give way to him willingly. We've seen that.
But I think that's smart to always hold that doubt open, because there's a lot of strange things that spring up from the unconscious.
Yeah.
And so I think we always need to hold back and so wait for the insight.
Right. My power is paralyzed, so the ego, think of ego, is being redirected by the self, but I survive in my son. Now, I think a repeat again in the third paragraph of what we saw when him saying, you know, I feel like a child, I feel like a woman in pregnancy. I love the beauty of the beautiful, the spirit of those rich in spirit, the strength of the strong. I laughed at the stupidity of the stupid. I despised the weakness of the weak, the meanness of the mean, and hated the badness of the bad. But now I must love the beauty of the ugly. That's ego and self shift. Something other than competitiveness. I think competitiveness must be learned. I told you about my 5-year-old friend and tic-tac-toe. But now I must love the beauty of the ugly, the spirit of the foolish, and so on. So that the other opposites are being honored as being important. And in back of my mind, whether this is right or not, I'm not sure, but in the back of my mind, I hear fascism in the background of all this. That what he's doing, too, is working through that idealism which had seized Germany. Hitler could say this. I love the beauty of the beautiful. The spirit of those rich in spirit, the strength of the strong. That's right out of Third Reich. And that was in the air, and Jung, in a way, could have been seduced by that power, and he's realizing how wrong it is, and he's telling himself why it's wrong, because it doesn't encompass all of human nature. And there is beauty in ugliness, there's strength and weakness, and there's weakness and strength, and so on. And I ironically, it's that idea of you must always be strong that defeated the Third Reich. Russia is what defeated the Nazis, and when those Germans in Russia during the cold winter were complaining they had no coats, Hitler said, be strong. And they froze to death. So, that's just a thought of mine, that Jung is not just working through his own power drive, but the idealization of power that was so strong in the war.
He does say it was in the air at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's pretty much top four paragraphs. Without him, last sentence, without him I would fall apart, but my life went on with him, my love remained with me. And I think ultimately he would see all those together as love, but he's feeling how his creativity is pulling him away from his marriage. That's how I understand it. At that point. And then he starts talking with his son. Let me read you that first sentence. Thus I entered into the solitude with a black look on my face, full of resentment and outrage at my son's dominion. So it's still a battle, but he's giving over to the demands of creativity. Then my son emerged, and then we start the dialogue. And that I think we'll look at closely. Because what I think's going on here, we talk back, I noted it down, page 321, remember where he kills the Kabiri? We said, is that right? I think he's reworking that here. And I'll try to explain why I think he's come back to that act and reversed it.
Aren't we getting the image then of the god Ion, the sun? Is the image of the lion's head and the,
yes,
the shimmering serpent skin covering his body?
Yes. But, well, let me just anticipate where we're going. I think what we're going to see now is all of that, it occurs to him, consists of two movements, living on the ground and going up to heaven. And he has to live on the ground, but the sun traverses between earth and heaven. By heaven, I would take to mean the source of inspiration. So the sun will make it clear to him, I go up and down, you got to stay here, but I go up and down. And the fact that Jung accepts that shows that the Kabiri are coming back to life. Because the Kabiri are that inspiration to creativity.
And also the soul, it's not just the sun, it's also the soul, who's a serpent and a bird.
Yeah. But he's realizing life is a dialectic between life on earth as things are, which we have to deal with, and the world of possibility, creativity, new inspiration, new ideas, which is antithetical to the way things are, but which we have to stay in touch with and try to bring those two together. And at different phases of our life, different aspects of that polarity will prevail. He has just gone through quite a strong trip to heaven, you might say, where he got all these new ideas. Now he's got to put them into creative writing. So he is the sun, okay? The work. Look a little bit, about halfway down that second block on the bottom of the first column, 325. I rise again. I had become flesh. Now I return to eternal glitter and shimmer, to the eternal embers of the sun, and leave you your earthliness. You will remain with men. You have been in immortal company long enough. Your work belongs to the earth.
So is this the journey out?
Right.
From the individuation process?
Right. That the work is saying to him, now you've got your ideas. Well, we'll see, that's a little too final. But you've got a set of ideas, now set about publishing them. set about trying them out in your analytic practice and writing them up. That's how I understand you. Your work belongs to the earth.
What is he writing at this point?
Nothing. Not until about 1928.
That's his first?
Well, he wrote Psychological Types in 1921. I've never been excited about that book. But the real symbolic stuff probably came with the Dream Analysis Seminar. That was 1928.
So all of his, most of his major works are after that?
After, from 1928 to 44. And this is how I would try to describe it. From 1928 to 1944, he wrote out what he had seen from 1913 to 1928.
So the concepts were there.
Concepts were there. Then with a heart attack, his focus changed.
Better get it written down.
It's almost like another trip up to heaven and back. Mm-hmm. And what changes is his concept of the archetype and synchronicity, you know, how they're related. Yeah. The let's say the mystery of the work took a little bit more of a center stage. But that's what goes on for quite a few paragraphs here. I had become man and beast and now ascend to my own country, meaning I've descended, and then I, where's your country? And then he, the work, says, in the light, the egg, and the sun, in what is innermost and compressed, in eternal longing, in the eternal longing embers. So that the work is saying, I come down to give you inspiration, and then I go back up to the source of inspiration. And I'm leaving you now, because you've got plenty of ideas. Get busy. Top of 329, how hard and solemn you are. Well, that's the way creativity is. It's a ruthless master. And then, apropos what we said earlier, you're a mother pregnant, giving birth. And he says, oh, Holy Spirit, grant me a spark of your eternal light. And the work says, you've already got it. You're with child. And then a little bit of a ramp. My soul, do you still exist? You serpent, you frog, you magically produced boy whom my hands buried, you ridiculed, despised, hated one who appeared to me in a foolish form. And then the work says, well, you're still a pregnant woman no matter what. No matter how much you gripe, you're still a pregnant woman. And I got to go back to where I live, which is in the realm of inspiration. But I'll be back. And then the voice, a little farther down, do not rail, I will be present and not present. You will hear and not hear me, I will be and not be. Remember what Jung put over the portal of his door in Kuznod? Mm-hmm. Called or not called, the God will be there. I wonder if it's a... Yeah, I wonder if this is a reference to that, because that would have come first. The house was built in 1909, and this was 1914. But it's the same idea, that you're not going to escape your creativity. I never understood why he put that on the lintel of his door in Kuznod. But I think this is a clue, that his creativity was not going to leave him alone. It's more of the same, I think, to till the end of that section. The final word from the work about halfway down that long, that last big paragraph, why lament, is I become light like the bird that rises up into the skies of morning. So that is the work, having one foot in the creative world of inspiration, another foot in the world of making those ideas public.
And he says he'll return to Jung in renewed form.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So this isn't the final...
No, that's why I thought it was reworking the death of the Kabiri, and, you know, this might be a little too definite, but I think the next big visit was in 1944, when he had his heart attack. And he, I wouldn't say he had a bunch of new ideas, some new ideas, but certainly more confidence in them. And his authorship is just so different after that, after 1944. It's just pure unconscious reporting. And whether you understand it or not, he's saying, it's not my problem. It's almost, you know, I don't know, maybe a bad analogy, but I think of it in terms of wine. Those last books are just the finest wine. And the ones before, they're a good wine. But it's like a real good wine has no ego. That's a dumb way to put it, maybe, but that's how I imagine it. It's just pure experience.
But it must spend some time in solitude.
Yes, in darkness.
Yes.
Remember my wine story about the cost of wine? Did I tell you that? I must have told you that. Well, I'll tell you again anyway. It's a wonderful story. I was in Switzerland. I had this Rotary Fellowship. And they assign a counselor to you. And the guy who was my counselor owned about 50 restaurants. And he would go to France to buy the wine for the restaurants himself and take his staff. And he told me this story. He said, we were buying wine, and they go to the vineyard, or the, well, they call them, what they, like the wine dealer, and, you know, they taste the wine, and they spit it out. They don't get drunk. They taste and spit it out. And so they tasted two wines that were almost the same. And I think he bought some of each for the restaurant. But one was expensive and one was not expensive, but the tastes were very similar. And one of his staff asked him, why would you spend that much more money for a wine that tastes almost the same as the other one? And he said, well, we'll discuss that at dinner. So at dinner, they went to a restaurant, and he ordered a bottle, after dinner, a bottle of the very good wine and a bottle of the pretty good wine. And he said to whoever had asked him the question, he said, now, have a few sips of each and see if you can tell me if there's a difference. And the person did. And I think it was a woman, actually. And and so he said to the woman, is there a difference? She said, well, there is kind of a difference. And he said, what is the difference? And she said, well, that more expensive one, there's just something you don't tire of. And he said, that's what you pay for. And I think for Jung's later work, it's like, I have been reading that stuff for 30 years. I never tire of it because it's just pure spirit. And that was the result of the second phase of his life, where that spirit probably came down and inspired him. That's how I tend to visualize it.
And it makes the difference when you drink that wine with, to how your palate has been prepared, maybe by the foods that mm-hmm. they ate, where you could distinguish a little more than just tasting.
Mm-hmm.
you know, wine after wine at mm-hmm. that really sort of thing. So carrying the palate is important to
mm-hmm. the okay. Well, we're winding down, folks. What has happened? I believe and accept that the God is something different from me. And the black book is soul. It says soul. Big shift. Now shut, you bronze doors. I have again racked my brains on those bronze doors. And I even came across a master's thesis on bronze doors. Submitted to the faculty of Louisiana State University, 2011, by Sarah Portera Cambras. It's actually quite a good paper. Some things I didn't realize. U.S. Supreme Court has bronze doors. The Senate chamber, U.S. Senate chambers, has bronze doors. They think the Parthenon might have had bronze doors. Apparently, many cathedrals have mm-hmm. bronze doors, and that is somewhat of a sign of the cathedral. She doesn't say so, but what occurred to me is that bronze doors would have been used since the Bronze Age. That may sound obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me at the beginning. So I don't fully get it, but what she says is in these places where there are, in churches particularly, and of course she refers to the baptistry in Florence, the bronze doors are portals to the other world, to the heavens, to the infinity. So maybe that's what he's driving at, that he has been in church. He has been receiving the voice from another world. Because he says, now shut you bronze doors, I open to the flood of devastation and murder, brooding over the peoples, open so as to midwife the God. Which I could take to mean that what he has been doing is hearing the voice of God coming through the church, but the church understood as an inner church.
And curiously enough, that this is 1914, right?
Yeah.
There was, I don't know if there's more than, surely there was probably more than one flood, but there was a flood in 1966 where the baptistry, where people literally brought sandbags in and they were trying to keep the water out.
And did they succeed?
No. And when they opened the doors, all the water
no kidding.
Out. Yeah. And the statue of Mary, which had been a carved wooden statue covered with gold leaf, was all the gold leaf. Most of the gold leaf was gone. She an earthly person again.
That is so interesting.
And it's such a neat piece to see.
Other thing I remember about the baptistry, I don't know if this is going to play in here, and I've tried to find pictures of it, but I haven't been able to. If you look at the top, there are two layers of, what would you call those, friezes up there, or is that a frieze? Or it's the band of art at the top of the wall, not on the ceiling, but whatever you call that. One layer is from the Middle Ages, and it shows that pessimistic, dark, cramped type of medieval art. And the layer above it is from the Renaissance, and it's full of joy and nature and light and lightness and women and men in, you know, talking and. I just thought, what a fantastic comparison of the shift between medieval and Renaissance mind, as if the, you know, life has been brought back. Now, whether that's relevant to this, I don't know, that life has been brought back. That's perhaps too far of a speculation. But in any case, I take it to mean I've got my revelation, I hear you, I'm going to get busy dealing with it. I'll just read the last paragraphs. I came to myself, a giddy and pitiful figure. My eye, I didn't want this fellow as my companion. So I take that to mean he's accepted how he has to change. I found myself with him. I'd prefer a bad woman or a wayward hound, but what... But one's own eye, this horrifies me. I love this next bit. An opus is needed that one can squander decades on. Well, that's exactly what he did. And do it out of necessity. I must catch up with the peace of the Middle Ages within myself. That's what alchemy is. Alchemy is the truths of the Middle Ages reinterpreted for the present time. We have only finished the Middle Ages of others. I must begin early in that period when the hermits died out. Asceticism, Inquisition, torture are close at hand and impose themselves. The barbarism requires barbaric means of education. My eye, you are a barbarian. I want to live with you. Therefore, I will carry you through an utterly medieval hell until you are capable of making living with you bearable. You should be the vessel and womb of life. Therefore, I shall purify you. The touchstone is being alone with himself, with oneself. This is the way. I think we should give ourselves a hand. The intensity is over. I've just read a couple of pages ahead, but what I think the scrutinies are not just reflections on what we've done, but there are more thoughts about the experience. This has been a record of the experience.
Page 336.
330. I got tired before I got that far.
Yeah, I know. I did too. I put it down.
Well, maybe I'll have to revamp what I've said, but we'll see.
So this new I, which is the son, his son, right?
Or he... No,
his ego.
His ego having accepted the point of view of the son.
Okay. Okay, yeah. That helps me out because I couldn't figure out why it was a barbarian and needed the medieval experience.
Yeah, he's talking about the ego, and then he formally introduces
right,
the ego.
Right, and the scrutiny, yeah.
Okay. And he must be intuiting the war coming up. See, the war hadn't started yet.
Yeah.
That really what that war was all the unresolved issues of Christianity bursting forth. And the medieval era was stable simply because it repressed that stuff. And it was coming back. So he's got to go back to that time, to what that era neglected, and rework it.
Because it was after the war, which we've talked about, that so much creativity erupted.
Yeah.
Along with the war.
Yeah. So in a way, he's in that same current. Maybe I'm... a little prejudice, but what bugs me about the creativity that did surface after the war is nobody understood it. Ego didn't connect with it. They were having a lot of fun and a lot of joy of creation, but did they understand what they were creating? That's what I wonder. Questions? If not, we'll move on. I want to take a breather.
can you mark these pages?
Exactly.
I wish he had made a painting of his worm son.
His worm son?
Yeah.
Maybe an artist in our current age would take up that challenge.
You know, it occurred to me.
You have a lot of worm-like creatures along the way.
What's that?
In the images, there are a lot of worm-like creatures that could be in, you know, early manifestation.
An inspiration to a contemporary artist, I wonder. Well, let's go on. Now, how to read this next section. Remember, as I said, I went over to, I know I assigned you a little further, but I got over to page 334, point number two, and I was exhausted, so I stopped. Well, I'll have to see what lies ahead. But at least in this page, this is a rant. He says in the footnote, it's a confrontation with the shadow. What I think we can learn out of this is, how does one deal with these rants? I don't think every point he makes is important. But if you have lived at all deeply, you will have had such an experience yourself. Call it a bad hair day, a depression, where all the voices say to you, you know, you're a fucking asshole, go jump off a bridge. And it actually does me good to see he wrestled with the same thing and survived. But the problem with these voices is they speak in black and white. They say, you are, you always. And the other problem is there is a grain of truth in them, but the truth is more like, yesterday you at one point made this slip. And it will take that slip and it will generalize it into a fault of your total character. So we have to go through it and look at what is being said, and it's more accurate to rephrase it as, sometimes I am this way, or I am somewhat this way. But those voices don't say sometimes and somewhat. They say all the time and totally. This is what is so dangerous about them. On the other hand, they often have a grain of truth. I remember when I first started teaching English in Switzerland, I taught at Swiss Air, which doesn't even exist anymore, but to their apprentices, the people who check you in at the airport and, you know, move your bags around. They had a 2-year apprenticeship for these kids. They were young kids. They were like 18 to 20. And, of course, they were pretty forthright about what they didn't like. And I would come home after teaching a lesson, which I didn't basically know what I was doing, and my voices would just tear me apart. So I wrote the voices down so that I wouldn't identify with them. And then at the end of the year, I asked the kids anonymously to write up a review of what they thought of my teaching. And most of them wrote very good constructive criticism. And their criticism was very much like what my voices had said to myself, but done with kindness. They didn't say, you're a lousy teacher. They said, you didn't do such a good job with the verbs. See the difference? So when you come across a text like this, what I thought I would do with you is just go through some of the points and talk about how would I reinterpret these voices to myself or to somebody else who went through a depression, did it in an act of imagination about what the voices were saying, so that one doesn't get overwhelmed by the negativity, but yet can hear some of the truth in what these voices are saying. So the first thing the voice says, and it harps on, is his pride and his ambition. And it's saying, you know, you're so, the voice in the paragraph is saying, you're so arrogant, you're so full of pride, and the fact is you are nothing. Now that's a classic depressive thought. Now why I would go back with that voice is what we referred to earlier. Pride is not wrong. The question is, where do I locate it? And I would say to it, maybe I do locate it too much in my ego. But I'm not going to accept that all pride is wrong. And if you're so concerned, voice, about my pride, show me where the healthy pride is. So you can kind of take it, and you can also kind of push back to it. And as I love what Edinger said about this, and I don't remember where I read it, but I would, if you ever come across it, keep the reference in mind, maybe pass it on to me. This is really his idea, that with Christianity, all pride is bad. He said, that's wrong. There is a healthy pride, and that pride is the pride you locate in the self. So that you're proud of what you accomplish. It doesn't matter who did it. It's that it has been done. That's healthy pride.
And is there healthy ambition?
Same.
Same thing.
Yeah, you can almost interchange ambition and pride here.
I just have to say, in reading this, it pretty much felt like the 12 years of Catholic education that I had, and the voices that you hear.
Yeah.
You've got to give me a nod.
But, yeah.
Do you think this is where he maybe was working on the idea of the enantiodromia, where you hear this, you push back, and you reject it all, and then you...
Yeah.
And you're just, it makes you bipolar or schizophrenic or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it just makes you crazy.
This is why people kill themselves. If you listen to this voice long enough, you think, why should I even exist? But what I think is going to be going on, and as I said, I'm just a few pages ahead of you, these scrutinies are his going back and thinking about, where do I stand with respect to what I've just experienced? The experience has been given. These are reflections. Now, as I say, that, I may have to correct that thought. That's what I believe at the moment. And it is quite natural that when you have a beautiful experience, the next dream that comes along is very dark. Because what the psyche is doing is saying, I've given you all this beauty, now look how far away you are from it. All the psyche cares about is that you are far away from it. What we got to worry about is, how do you expect me to be otherwise? I just learned it yesterday. Give me a break here. And I think you've got to speak back to these things. The good thing about these dark experiences are they keep goading you to take the experience seriously. The bad thing about them is they can goad you so much that you give up. So it's not strange that you would get something like this, that compared to what he has just seen, he's a pretty paltry version of his own experience. He probably still was ambitious, probably still was prideful. But what I would help a guy to do in that boat is, one, realize what a beautiful thing he'd experienced. Two, it is natural that you haven't achieved it. And three, not all of your qualities are bad. Let's look at this and this and how it works sometimes and begin to change that. But not accept the generalization.
And to me, that kind of ties into Jared, that he picks so much of it and then he says, wait a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, I have this friend who's, you heard me talk about it, his psychiatry residency, and, you know, they talk about depressive thinking and reality-based thinking. So when they hear somebody depressed, to see whether it's a inner depression, they look for the data that would support the depression. And what I think the difference between that medical way or even cognitive behavioral way and what way we work at it, just because there's no data to support it doesn't mean it's false. it could be that that depression gives much that's false, but there are certain parts of it which are to be honored. And we try to distinguish what we reject and what we keep. Because those depressions can give very valuable information. But in this form, you can't swallow it. The voice says, pitiful creature, I will torment you. Well, I'd have to say to that, excuse me, I'm not pitiful. I may need tormenting, but I happen to have some value. And then we have that love bit coming up again. And then about halfway down the first column, how now do you want to speak? Remember, this is the shadow speaking the whole time. My soul is with the fireworm. Well, we've already seen that, and that simply says to me that he's being reminded that part of him will always be connected to this erotic aspect of life. And he has to listen to what his eros is doing continually. And the voice says, you are not my soul. So that I take that to mean you don't determine where the eros goes. That's a separate experience. And you've got to learn to follow that. And he says, you are my bare, empty nothing. And I say, excuse me, I happen to be something. Otherwise, how could you exist? You've got to talk back to these voices and hear them, both. Here's a classic. I regret that I misspeak such truths to you. I don't think you regret it at all. I think you're enjoying this. Now, yes, you are laughably sensitive, self-righteous, unruly, mistrustful, pessimistic, cowardly, dishonest with yourself, venomous, vengeful. One can hardly speak about your childish pride, your craving for power, your desire for esteem, your laughable ambition, your thirst for fame without feeling sick. Now, I might say, you know what, sometimes I am sensitive. Give me an example. Maybe I am self-righteous. Sometimes. When was I self-righteous? And so on. Hold these voices down and pin down their generalizations to a sometimes, somewhat, give me an example, or shut up.
I see this is the difference between a bad parent and a good parent. The bad parent is very shaming, and the child may act right, but then may, with his own children, shame them and be very self-righteous to them and always never be vulnerable, whereas a better parent would be able to say, you did this wrong, I want you to change this, but you are a good person.
Yeah. Or, you've done a great job here and here, now let's talk about how we can improve here.
And I think one of the problems that you can see with cognitive behavioral therapy, is you get someone who is shaming themselves, and then they go out and instead of going from being passive to more assertive, they go from passive to aggressive to passive to aggressive, and just make a bigger mess than they started out.
Well, that's, in a way, how I would try to understand these two pages. You can look at each instance. You wanted to tell people what to do, what's so great about you. You wanted to complain about others, but are you any better? And again, this whole vanity thing is being leveled at him.
Is the shadow projecting? Is the shadow projecting?
Yeah, you could say that, actually. I hadn't thought of that. I think you could.
Well, but still he has to go through these and tease the truth.
That's the problem. You cannot accept it prima facie.
And you cannot deny it.
You can't deny it, but you can accept it, and you've got to filter out the grains of truth in the big vat of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that part of the criticism of Christianity that Young made, was that the God image rejected all of the bad thoughts with the human?
Yeah.
So that would make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the way it's always been. I mean, everything I've read is just the same thing on it. The God's projecting on humans. And then punishing them.
Now we get slipped in a grain of truth. You complain that the torment has not yet come to an end. Let me tell you, it has only just begun. Well, torment's too strong, but I think it would be safe to say to a guy like that. Life's not going to be easy. And if you want to be true to your values, to your creative voice, it will be a value. But I might add, and it's worth it. So again, it's like we're getting glass half empty, and there would be a glass half full way to reframe that. And I would also say to the voice, look, you seem to be so interested in my changing, but do you realize the way you are telling me I can never change from that amount of attack? If you're so interested in my changing, put it in a way I can assimilate. So that idea continues for quite a while. Learn silence. Well, that's good advice. I will pin all your unjust and depraved words one by one to your body with needles so that you can feel how evil words stab. Again, it's too negative. You rise against me, I am screwing the vice tighter. That's all. I will break your bones until there is no longer a trace of hardness there. Again, there's a slight grain of truth in that. If you continually avoid the self, there's a price to pay. But one also needs support from the unconscious to pull that off. And with this voice only, you'll never do it.
And you also need a suppleness within yourself to be able to receive what you need to receive. And you need hardness, too, to speak back to these voices. So to take out every trace of hardness is too much.
Yeah, that's exactly how you have to work with this stuff. Well, why don't we stop at that point? I'll say we've gotten to right before "For I Want to Get Along with You," which I don't believe.
That's Jung talking.
Well, is
it? He says, "For I want to get along with you, I must be in you, you are my eye." So Jung's talking to...
Well, I thought it could be the shadow saying, "You are my eye."
Yeah, because the eye in the world.
Which I must carry around with me to my grave. I think it's Jung talking.
That could be. Yeah, it could be. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll pick up on that. You got the basic idea. We won't harp on this. You might just reread this yourself in that light. How do you work with depressive attacking complexes? Is remind it that what it says is true sometimes, somewhat, not all the time, and not completely, and that you have a right to speak back. And if the voice is so concerned about your changing, remind it, you need to hear what it's saying in a way that you can actually deal with. It gets a little better on at the bottom of 344. So I think, how did you read to what? 336.
Before the number
6. Yeah. I don't know how fast this is going to go. So what do you think? Read to 339, maybe?
All of 339.
Well, to, what did it say, before number 4? And I'll say we got to 333, right before 4I1. We'll pick up there, 4I1. And this may go faster, it may go slower, I'm not sure. But I think we've got the meat of it under our belts. And this, I believe, will be commentary. Okay, thank you.